Well, hello again, Wardville Community Church. It's Monday, May the 15th, 2023. This is In the Know, episode 71. Well, let's jump straight in, and we will start out with some announcements. This Wednesday night, 2 days from now, Wednesday, May 17th, Women's Gathering. That is at Ronnie Williams' house at 6:30, Myrtlewood Manor. May the 24th will be the men's gathering, location to be determined, at 6:30 p.m. May the 27th, that Saturday, is a baby shower for Marjorie Lombard at the Williams residence, 2 p.m. We also have on the week of June the 4th, the first week of June, Summer Book Club will kick off. If you're interested in being part of that, please, by all means, let me know and go ahead and purchase that book, The Common Rule. In the month of July, we have Backyard Bible Clubs coming up, so please make plans to be there for that. Next Sunday, May the 21st, we will be studying Hebrews 7, verses 11 through 22. Let's jump straight into the Melchizedek conundrum. So let's chat about Melchizedek's identity for a moment. I've called this the Melchizedek conundrum, and here's why. Everyone in our evangelical, Bible-loving, conservative circle wants to do justice to the text of Scripture without nullifying it or invalidating it in some meaningful way. That creates a difficulty, though, when approaching the identity of Melchizedek. There is no completely satisfying answer to this question that doesn't somehow raise more issues. Therefore, the question really becomes, which unanswered questions are you most comfortable with? Like, what tension are you okay to live with? Because all of the options on the table, you're going to have some kind of tension. It won't resolve every question. Let's discuss three of the major options. Really, in my opinion, the only three options. And I will hopefully show you how none of them perfectly addresses all the issues, makes precise sense of the text, and then fails to raise more issues. In other words, all these options will end up leaving you with further questions. So theory one, Melchizedek was just a man. This is the main interpretation of the church going back many centuries. Like, there is no indication in the Genesis narrative that he was anything other than a man. Then you get to Hebrews, and these phrases are said about him. No mother, no father, no genealogy. Literally, it's the word in Greek for father and ah, that's in Greek called the alpha privative, the ah. So we talk about agnostic. There's an A at the beginning of the word gnosis, knowledge, without knowledge, right? Without or no. Literally, no father, no mother, no genealogy. Having no beginning of days nor end of life, he continues a priest forever. It's testified in the scriptures about him that he lives. How do we maintain the truthfulness of these words and still also maintain he's just a man? How do we do justice to this text without somehow saying, well, that's not really true? We must insist upon the truthfulness of the Bible while also maintaining that these words can only be literally true of God himself, which is actually why many people come down on theory two below. The only way that people have kind of made this work is to say that these are true in Melchizedek, of Melchizedek, in what I called yesterday a literary as opposed to a literal sense. That is, in what the text of Genesis 14 itself records about him. It is what one author calls an argument from silence, taking what is not said and then turning that into positive statements. As an actual man, he must have had father, mother, and genealogy. As a man, he must have had a birth and a death. And as a man, it is true that he lives forever in God's presence, but he is not currently walking the earth right now, ministering as a high priest. So these words are true in the sense that they describe Genesis 14's silence about him, thus making him a typological pattern for the Christ of whom these things are actually literally true. In other words, what is implied about Melchizedek from the silence is actually true of Jesus, the greater than Melchizedek. Okay, theory two, Melchizedek was the pre-incarnate Son of God. This is the only way that I can conceive of that the words of Hebrews 7 could be literally true of Melchizedek. Like, there is a precedence in the Old Testament for appearances, we call them theophanies, of God as a man. See Genesis 18 when Yahweh and two angels visited Abraham. The issues are that nothing in the text of Genesis 14 would lead us to believe that it was Yahweh in the flesh. So like, if you don't have Hebrews 7, if you don't have Psalm 110, you just assume that this is a man, right? In Genesis 18, Abraham knows that he is in Yahweh's presence. The text itself actually begins with, "And Yahweh appeared to him," right? But in Melchizedek, in this story in Genesis 14, there's no indication that Abraham is aware that this is somehow God in the flesh, and there's no indication given that this is somehow God in the flesh. Additionally, there seem, at least to me, to be a number of problems with the pre-incarnate Son of God ruling a people bodily on the earth before his incarnation, humiliation, resurrection, exaltation, and return. Right? So just think about like an extended period of rule on the earth. Right? Why did Abraham, if that was what that was, not seek to live within the kingdom of the Son? In what way did the Son, the pre-incarnate Son, offer sacrifices to God if he was later to become the sacrifice and the great high priest? Right? So if his first priesthood was insufficient, right, to the point that it needed another one, why did it exist at all? Like, why would the Son come as an insufficient priest first, only to come later as an all-sufficient priest? And if it was a sufficient priesthood, which you would expect the Son of God's priesthood would be all sufficient, or he offers a once for all sacrifice, why did there need to be another one? Or a Levitical priesthood for that matter? And then in Hebrews 7, why would the author mention that Melchizedek resembled the Son of God rather than telling us that he was the Son of God? This would be the perfect opportunity when discussing this mysterious figure about whom, by the way, there are tons of theories circulating at the time of the writing of this letter, right? Why not take this moment to address the identity of this mysterious figure in such a way that the readers then understand that it was the Son all along who was setting up the pattern for his own ministry that was to come? But we have none of that. In some ways, Hebrews 7 actually only adds mystery and intrigue to the identity of Melchizedek rather than clearing it up. And then theory three, Melchizedek was an angel. This is one of the most out there theories, in my opinion. It doesn't really satisfy my mind in any way. On the one hand, Melchizedek would not be a man, which does not satisfy the appearance of the text of Genesis 14. Right? Although angels can take the form of men, we are usually given clues that this is what's happening. And the same issues that apply to Melchizedek being the Son of God in some ways apply here. What is the purpose of having an angel be a king priest, and how would this set the pattern for the God-man's high priestly ministry? This being is neither God nor man. What precedent is there for anything other than a chosen man standing between man and God? The whole point of a priest is that he is a holy, set apart man who represents men to God and God to men. Likewise, the same unsatisfying things about Melchizedek being a man also apply here. Angels have a beginning of life. They came into existence at a point of time, and therefore they technically have a father, even if they have no mother or genealogy. Right? So if God made them, in some sense, he is their father, though not in the same sense as he is our father. So once again, these words cannot all be literally true of an angel. For those reasons, this is the least satisfying answer in my mind of the three options. So I've basically decided that given the text of Genesis 14, I am most okay with the problems raised by theory one more than I am with the problems that exist with theories two and three. I'm assuming that the author of Hebrews is not literally trying to make his audience believe that these things are true, but only typologically true, based on the omissions of details in Genesis 14. I believe it makes the most sense of all the data from Genesis 14, Psalm 110, and Hebrews 7. Of course, you're free to disagree. Study these things and draw your own conclusions. Hold them loosely and be open to being convinced otherwise. And thank God that our salvation does not depend upon knowing Melchizedek's identity, but rather depends upon our great high priest who ministers in the order of Melchizedek. Here are a couple of quotes from men who said it better than I can. First, Al Mohler from Exalting Jesus in Hebrews. He says, a closer reading of this text reveals the eternality of Melchizedek's personhood is not the subject of this verse. At issue is Melchizedek's priesthood. Melchizedek was not a priest because his father was a priest, nor was he a priest who had successors. By providing this familiar background, which means not at all, the author is trying to communicate the unprecedented nature of Melchizedek's priesthood. Right? Melchizedek is a priest of God Most High by divine ordination. Melchizedek enters into the Genesis story as if he has no mother, no father, and no sons. This kind of priesthood stands in stark contrast with the priesthood of Israel, which was entirely based on Levitical familial descent. Okay, and then Philip Edgecombe Hughes, in a commentary on the Epistle to the Hebrews, he says, Melchizedek is introduced in isolation from all family bonds. This description, without father or mother or genealogy, accordingly, should not be taken literalistically to mean that Melchizedek had no parents or family, nor does the statement that he had neither beginning of days nor end of life intend us to understand him as an eternally existent being who experienced neither birth nor death. The point is that these assertions apply positively to Christ, not to Melchizedek. The significance of the biblical silence is that it marks Melchizedek out as a type who in these respects resembles the Son of God, who alone exists everlastingly from eternity to eternity. Surrounded by this silence, Melchizedek is the figure, but Christ is the reality. If you're interested in seeing from 2021 the Melchizedek studies that we did when we were in Genesis, I've shared the sermon audio and the Google Doc to my manuscript there as a link, and I've also shared the newsletter from July 15th. Also, I've left in there, and I will for a little while, the technology conference links that take you to Facebook, sessions 1-4 that we did with Kingsville. So, let me just end by reading Hebrews 7:22, because this is what kind of the arguments are building toward from these first 22 verses of Hebrews. This makes Jesus the guarantor of a better covenant. Christ is better. Have a great week. I love you, people.